The President's Distinguished Lecture Series has a long tradition of inviting eminent scholars to Victoria. It is now my real great pleasure to invite Dr. Vandana Shiva to present her distinguished lecture entitled The Future of Food. Dr. Vandana Shiva.
University, the Chancellor, the Vice-Chancellor, the faculty, Nancy, Peter Keller, everyone for honouring me with this honorary doctorate, but really honouring you all, because these are your issues. These are your concerns. For me personally, it's been quite a long journey from the days when I was absolutely passionate about the quanta and the psi function. I slept, dreamt, woke with the psi function and thought that would be my life. I had chosen to be preoccupied with it. And yet such a large part of my life since then has been preoccupied with the seed and food. Not because I had imagined this is where I would spend my time and energy, but in a way, it's the issues which called for attention. For me, food is as much of an interrelated thing as a quantum is. It is the sunshine that fell on the leaf and through photosynthesis made the plant what it is and then created the entire food chain. It's the soil organisms, and we find out more and more how much they are responsible for giving us food. The little mycorrhizae that can travel miles as fungi to pick up that tiny bit of a nutrient to bring it to a plant. The earthworms that Charles Darwin said when human history is finally written, will be the ones who are real, understood to be the basis of human survival on this planet. The bees and the butterflies, who we've treated so carelessly, 75% of the bees are gone. And Einstein has said, when the last bee goes, the human species disappears. Without the pollinators, there would be no food. And the UNEP has just done calculations that they are giving us ecological services worth $50 billion. That is what Senior President Bush had calculated as the biotechnology industry and walked out of the Convention on Biological Diversity in 1992. And the bees and the pollinators are just one aspect of the food system. The water that is in the soil, in our rivers, in the ground. The biodiversity that embodies millions of years of evolution with millions of expressions, 300 million species, and then thousands of years of the knowledge of our ancestors who have carefully increased the diversity from a few wild plants. Look at the corn in Mexico. In India, 200,000 varieties of rice evolved with a partnership between people and nature, largely women. We have 50,000 edible plants on the planet. Humans have eaten about 8,500 species through their history. And yet today, most of these species are forgotten. And we are focusing on about 15 globally traded commodities, which provide 90% of the calories. Three provide 60%, rice, wheat, corn. But most of the acreage that is expanding is corn and soya, canola, cotton, because that's what's genetically engineered and that's what brings in the royalties. Food is the ecological web of life. It is culture, it is politics, and we have an old ancient Upanishad, the Taittiriya Upanishad, which says everything is food. Everything is something else's food. And then when you realize that, you won't draw a pyramid of species with man at the top. You will put the microorganisms above man because they get us in the end. We are food for them. And that should teach us a little humility. Yet food today is not being understood in this living web as the very source of life, as life itself and that which gives us life. It's being seen as just another commodity, like iron ore, like bauxite, something to be produced for profit, and it doesn't matter what it costs, it doesn't matter what its consequences are for health, for ecological balance, for the livelihoods and lives of the poor. Most of the grain being grown today is no longer food. Even though the argument that carries on and on and on is that it's about feeding the world. Always about feeding the world. Green Revolution was about feeding the world. Genetic engineering is about feeding the world. 90% of the corn and soya is not eaten by human beings. Most of it is going to torture animals. I don't call it animal feed, because herbivores didn't want grain in the first place. That's why they call herbivores. They want herbs. They want grass. And a large part is being diverted for driving cars and running the biofuel industry. And of course, if you follow the discussions at the Rio Plus 20 summit in June of this year, 20 years after the original Earth Summit, the big discussion was around the green economy. The fossil fuel industry, realizing fossil fuels are running out, and for the short time, frack a little here, get the tar sands to squeeze out a little bit of oil. But they're preparing for oil and chemicals and everything else that oil has given us, now from plants and biomass. And as some of the scientists who are working on this say, most of the biomass of the world is not being used. And when I think of my sisters of the Chipko movement, who protected the forest, everything they needed came from the forest. The fuel, the fodder, the food, because that's where they transported the organic matter that was then fed to the animals as fodder. And that is what created the renewable soil fertility. Not only do the poor of the world use biomass, nature uses biomass. And to think that if nature uses it and the poor use it, it is not utilized, it is going waste, is the basis of what we are witnessing today, the great land grab. You know, why are millions of acres being grabbed in Africa? For biofuel, not for food. And as this industrial system deepens, the future of food becomes a future of non-food. In the sense that the commodities don't give food, and what little is eaten is not food anyway. It's not worthy of being called food. We have a beautiful word that my sisters used once when I traveled with them to Europe, and they wouldn't touch the food. They said it's abhaksha. Not worthy of eating. And because I was doing an organic festival, I had all the forgotten foods, the grain, the mandua, the ragi with me. He said, can you give us some of those grains so we can cook it? Because this industrial food is not worthy of eating. It's not worthy of eating because it has been transformed so badly that it is no more nourishment for our bodies. It is no more fitting into the food web. It is poisoning the food web. It is disrupting the food web. But this future that is being pushed and imposed is also a future that threatens our very fundamental freedoms. There used to be a time when people used to say bread or freedom. Today it's about bread and freedom. Because if our bread isn't free, all other freedoms don't exist. And there isn't freedom if 5%, five companies control 75% of the seed supply, which has already happened. And most of these companies have their origins in war. So what's the expertise they bring to food? How to turn agriculture, which should be the ultimate place for peace, into warfare? The fertilizers are made in former explosives factories. The herbicides are war chemicals. Agent Orange, remember Vietnam? They're now using Agent Orange on the farms of the United States because the Roundup Ready soya has led to such high emergence of weeds that are resistant to Roundup that they're now having to use Agent Orange. And of course, pesticides were designed to kill people, and they continue to kill people. The Bhopal disaster, you remember? There's a cancer train that leaves Punjab, the land of the Green Revolution. And yet, while the food is poisoned, either with chemical sprays from outside or putting toxic genes into the crops that will become food, we've reached this insane situation that we reward those who contaminate and pollute our food chain and the food web with monopolies. And we actually have now made laws that treat the polluting industry at the genetic level as the creators of life. A patent is granted for someone who has created something new, someone who has made an invention, and gives the patent holder an exclusive right to deny anyone else from making, using, selling, distributing the patented product. But when seed is patented, it means that the farmer saving seed is now treated as an intellectual property thief. These laws of intellectual property on seed were globalized through the World Trade Organization. And a representative of my favorite company, Monsanto, his name was James Enyart, the moment the treaty came into effect, said in a speech in Washington, "We achieved something unprecedented." And it's true, they achieved something unprecedented. He said, "We wrote a law, took it to our government, which then imposed it on the rest of the world. We were the patient, diagnostician, physician, all in one." The claim that genetic engineering would feed the world repeatedly has been shown to be false. We've done a report called "The Emperor Has No Clothes." The GMO emperor has no clothes. One claim was that we have more food, no increase in yields. The yields come from the original plant, not from the toxic gene that you put into it. No reduction of chemicals, which was the big issue. You won't have to use chemicals. In the US, a doubling. In the cotton areas of India, a 13-fold increase in pesticides. Argentina, more than 10 times more herbicides being used. And these seeds that are now patented cost much more. They're non-renewable. You have to buy them every year. In India, the GMO seeds, the price jumped 8,000% overnight. Seed that farmer could save now had to be bought. And because it was a uniform seed sold across seasons, across regions, it failed very frequently. This year, the genetically modified cotton has dropped by 40% in production. And the combination of these vulnerabilities and high costs has pushed our farmers into debt. And the resilient Indian farmers who would survive floods and droughts and tragedies are now starting to commit suicide, something we've never seen before. Never. 270,000 of them, more than 250,000. And your own Percy Smyser, the farmer in Prairie, sued after his field was contaminated. Cases going on all over the world. The Brazilian farmers have sued Monsanto $2.2 billion. There's a farmer called Bauman being sued by Monsanto for having bought seed in an elevator and planting it in his farm. But the concentration of power and the abuse of power and the violation of democratic norms of society reached its peak last night. Yesterday, President Obama had to sign a law that would allow the spending for this year. You know, they've been on the fiscal cliff, they keep saying. I think they're on a democratic cliff. And this law, H.R. 993, which is supposed to be about expenditure. In the defense section of expenditure, Monsanto tucked in Section 735, which is called by the movements now the Monsanto Protection Clause. And if I was to read it out to you, so why on earth is that in a defense section? It's basically saying Monsanto has total immunity. No court can rule against it. No government can rule against it. And to me, this kind of behavior is a fascism. I would say one future for food is the emergence of a food fascism. Not just this absolute uncontrollable power by a handful of corporations, but also the abuse of law against innocent farmers who are saving seeds. We've created a whole global movement on seed freedom because friends in Europe are being sued if they're saving seeds. Friends in Latin America are being sued for saving seeds. They tried to pass a law like that in 2004 in India. But I've learned good lessons from Gandhi. And Gandhi had told us that as long as the superstition exists that unjust laws must be obeyed, so long will slavery exist. In South Africa, he resisted apartheid and the identities and said, we won't wear these badges. And the action took place on another 9/11, 1901. He said, we will not be divided by race. And in India, there are many satyagrahas, but the one that most people know is when the British, realizing that in tropical climates we need a lot of salt, thought this would make a lot of money if they could make salt a monopoly. And they passed a law saying no one can make salt except the British. And Gandhi walked to the beach, picked up the salt from the sea, and said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will continue to make salt. We will not. And taking inspiration from that, from the day I started seed saving in 1987, every farmer who we work with takes a simple pledge that we've received this amazing biodiversity and seeds from nature and our ancestors. We owe it to future generations to protect the richness of diversity, the integrity of the seed, and therefore we cannot obey any law that makes our seed saving a crime because it violates our ecological rights. And since we have to obey higher law, the law of Gaia, the law of the planet, the law of social justice, the law of protecting the rights of future generations. We do not recognize patents on seed, which is a rip-off anyway. How can you put a toxic gene into a plant and say, I'm the creator? And basically, GMO is God move over. I'm God. Millions of years of evolution is being undone. Centuries of cultural history and economic history is being erased. For what? A future that will not be a future. because of the very basis of the web of life is being assaulted, if the very basis of freedom is being destroyed, that is not a future. That is why we must cultivate another future, one based on diversity, decentralization, and localization, like you are trying to do here in Vancouver Island. And I was so delighted yesterday to have attended a panel discussion where I realized that this university is committed to local procurement of ecologically produced food. That is the model we have to move towards, not the dominant model based on monopolies and monocultures and the necessity to introduce militarization into the food system. We have to make peace with our food. The first step in cultivating this other future is to save the first link in the food chain, the seed. Very often when we think of food, we don't think of the seed. Most young children don't even know food begins in seed. And that's a literacy we will have to begin creating. Through Navdanya, we've done it across the country. More than 500,000 farmers have joined our programs for seed sovereignty and food sovereignty. And just remembering some simple things. That seed is not an intellectual property commodity you buy every year. It's in the seed if it's open pollinated to renew itself. In abundance, you plant one seed, the seed will give you thousands. In the case of millets, and they are called millets, because one seed gives you a million. The word millets come from a million seeds. The most nutritious crops, using hardly any water, 250 millimeters, yet driven out of our food culture everywhere in the world. Because, A, they're dark. And you know, there's a problem that white is superior. And B, because they're not globally traded. And this idea of globally traded commodities shaping our farming systems is the reason so much of diversity has disappeared. A lot of our work in Navdanya, beginning with seed saving and then bringing seed saving into production, has shown that actually if we want to increase food production, we've got to increase diversity. You can't feed the world with five commodities that don't go for food. 80% of the food eaten today, 2013, is coming from small farms and gardens. Not from the giant industrial farms of the Midwest of the US. That's not a food system. The food system is where we have these amazing, nurturing, life-giving links between the soil and the plants and the animals and the human community. And that is the reason that what is happening in Canada with the Idle No More movement is so inspiring to me. Because in a way, the dominant industrial agriculture system, and then linked to the globalization of trade, was basically saying to most species, you get idle. We don't need you. In the many years I've had debates with the biotech industry, I remember two particular incidents. One, when they said that the bees usurp the pollen. And their technologies prevent bees from usurping the pollen. And the other was even nicer. They said the herbicide-resistant crops prevent the weeds from stealing the sunshine. So in a mindset where bees are thieves, biodiversity is a thief, farmers saving seeds are thieves, the thief is the one who says, I will decide how you will live. And the Idle No More movement is saying, we won't allow our knowledge, our cultures, our history to be wasted. We won't allow our future to be wasted, because the dominant system is a culture of waste. It's a culture of waste because it's not using the full potential of the soil and the earth and the seed to give us the food we could be growing. It is a waste because it is wasting people. And it's a waste because it literally is throwing away 50% of the food. There's nothing efficient about it. How could something that uses 10 times more energy than it produces as food be called efficient? Ecological systems produce twice as much. And we all do all this with a very false idea that somehow we are producing more food. We are not. We are producing less food and more commodities. And meantime, we are destroying the planet. 75% biodiversity, 75% water, 75% soil degradation are a consequence of industrial, non-sustainable agriculture. That's 75% of the ecological problem. And my book, Soil Not Oil, analyzed that 40% of the greenhouse gases come from an industrialized, globalized system of agriculture. So this is the big chunk of the ecological problem. But it's also a big chunk of the human health problem. 1 billion people are hungry. 2 billion are suffering from diseases of obesity, diabetes, none of which existed till a bad food system became the dominant system. And then add to it the cancers, the allergies, everything else that comes from the toxics that are going into our food system. I would think 75% of all public health, human health problems are coming from a culture of producing and pushing bad food. So 75% of the ecological problem starts to get solved when we turn towards ecological agriculture. 75% health problems start to get addressed when we start cultivating food for nourishment and health rather than food for mere profits. And in our 2.5 decades of work, what we have found is that the more biodiverse, ecological, local a food system is, the more food per acre and nutrition per acre it produces. We've done a report called Health Per Acre. And just working on the kind of farms we have helped develop, including our own farm in Dehradun, we could be feeding 2 Indias. It doesn't have to be the case that every 4th Indian is hungry, as is the reality today, and every 2nd Indian child is wasted and stunted. The model that says we are feeding the world is in fact creating hunger and malnutrition in the world, because it's not looking at nutrition, it's not looking at people, it's not looking at their rights. We could produce enough food for 14 billion, 20 billion humans on the planet. And I'm not saying we must have those numbers, because we need to share this planet with others. But we can increase the availability of nutrition and healthy food by intensifying biodiversity, ecological processes, love and care. It's a very important ingredient in food. Intensifying knowledge. The knowledge of farmers, the knowledge of processors, the knowledge in universities, of food systems as a whole. So far, what is called intensive agriculture, and then there's an illusion that somehow intensive means more, all that has been intensified is toxic chemicals, which means more disease and more ecological problems, capital inputs, which mean more debt, more mortgages, more destruction of family farms, carelessness and violence. Every time an industry will tell you, I'm bringing a new technology that doesn't need the farmer to think. And I always say, no, we want thinking farmers. We don't want careless farmers. And we don't want a culture of ignorance about food, how food is grown, how the soil works, how biodiversity relationships work, what happens when you mess around with food. We are in an ocean of ignorance, a deep ocean of ignorance. All of chemical fertilizers are based on three nutrients, NPK. That every element of the periodic table is needed in the soil, in our bodies, and in the plant. The myth of cheap is the second big myth. Comes up all the time. Organic is a luxury, local is a luxury, ecological is a luxury. But how is it that seeds that cost 8 to 10,000% more give you cheap food? How is it that a food system subsidized with $400 billion, that's more than a billion a day, is called cheap? You wouldn't need any cutbacks if we got rid of those agribusiness subsidies. Nothing. And how can 75% of the destruction of the planet and people's health be counted as cheap? This myth of cheap food will have to be addressed in a systemic way. And this is where universities come in. Farmers cultivate good food. Those who distribute food locally put in their energy. But deconstructing the myths of more and cheap, it is university communities that have to work with local communities to nurture the food system that does give us a real future. And finally, of course, the challenge is democracy. We won't be able to create another food culture, another food economy, if we do not reinvigorate our democracies, from the local to the regional to the global level. The dictatorship over the earth, the seed, our food, has to have an alternative. And that alternative will come from our gardens and our farms, our kitchens and our tables. And can you imagine what an opportunity we've been given that every day, three times a year, we can create a revolution? Every day, three times, by making the right choices. We have no excuse to be passive observers, to see our beautiful earth destroyed, to see our health and our children's health destroyed. It is too basic an issue for us to not be part of the change we want to see. And I want to end with both a recognition of the fact that we are living in tyrannical times. We are living in times where there's a conscious destruction of democracy. And there's a Palestinian poem that has always inspired me since I started Navdanya. And it's a long poem, I won't read the whole, but it ends with this: I do not fear your tyranny, I do not despair ever, for I guard one seed, a little life seed, which I will save and plant again. And this beautiful, inspiring poem from Rumi that a seed activist just sent me as they joined the seed freedom campaign that we have launched worldwide. In this earth, in this immaculate field, we shall not plant any seeds except for compassion, except for love. Monsanto-free food system, and you're going to create it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Schieber, for just really, truly inspiring words. So, this is your time. This is time for questions. So here are the ground rules. This is being recorded. And so we have six microphones located in the room. We have one microphone up there, one microphone up there, one microphone in the middle there, one microphone in the middle there, and then two microphones on top, and they're all just magically being lit up. So what we're going to ask you to do is to, if you have a question, find your way to one of the microphones, and then we'll take questions in turn. And Dr. Schieber has had a hard 2 days of work here, so I promised her that we'll get her to her hotel room in good time. So eventually we will shut questions down. Yes?
Dr. Schieber, is this working? Okay. Dear Dr. Schieber, thank you for your truly inspiring talk. I just wondered, the average human being, you know, I don't have a chair, I'm trying to do my best, trying to survive. How would you suggest that we organize to fight for a seat? How do you suggest we organize to fight against Monsanto and all those Archer Daniel Midlands and all those agribusiness firms that seem to want to make us all eat the same basmati rice or the same millet or the same grains? You know, how would you suggest we do that? Do you have a blueprint? Because I personally would want your suggestions, and I'm prepared to be your shisha.
Yeah, I don't write blueprints. I want you to write your own. But I think the beauty of food is, it isn't like a fighter jet. We can grow it. The beauty of seed is you just have to find the one open pollinated seed. And you can save it and you can multiply it and you can distribute it. And that's why I say to everyone, start saving seeds. You don't have to be a farmer to save seeds. It can be that one plant in your balcony, in your garden. Every garden must become a seed sanctuary. And just as they are open source software, we have to dedicate ourselves to open source seed, open pollinated seed, which are the seeds of freedom. And this year, the Seed Freedom Campaign is dedicating itself to seeds of freedom, gardens of hope. Everywhere where there's a garden, there's a no to Cargill, ADM, Monsanto.
We take the lower microphone first and then the upper one.
Thank you so much for your inspiration, your passion, your vision of the future. When it comes to the field of climate change, one of the most exciting citizens' movements at the moment is the student disinvestment movement to ask universities to disinvest their whole portfolios from fossil fuels. Is there an equivalent movement for students to disinvest their food supply from genetically modified food?
There should definitely be. I've launched one in Norway. As you know, Norway, in the oil,
yes,
is not owned by the Chinese or other investors. It's owned by the Norwegian public. And therefore, every investment can be subjected to an ethical committee. And I was in Norway about 2 years ago to launch a Monsanto disinvestment campaign. And I think the oil industry and Monsanto, biotech industry, Cargill, Shell, they're all becoming one. They're all merging. And I think what we need is disinvestment of public money in any form from these companies and an investment into life-nourishing, living economies.
So if the University of Victoria was to look for inspiration to another university which had already said on its food supply, we will not sell any genetically modified food at the university, is there another university they could look for leaders, or does UVic need to be the global champion?
I think UVic should be the champion, shouldn't it?
You're obviously a very compassionate and hardworking and intelligent, brave woman. I'm a nurse, and I'm going through some burnout right now. And how do you find the compassion and the energy to continue to do the amazing things that you do?
Well, first I want to tell you, speaking, I used to run away from it. I was the head girl of my school, and I didn't find anything that was worse torture than getting up in front of the school to speak. But I became comfortable with speaking when I realized it was something about something more than me. And the way to deal with not burning out is to realize you're part of a bigger world. Both because it nourishes you, but in giving, as St. Francis said, in giving, you receive.
Hi there. I'd just like to say that you're very inspiring to me, and you're as beautiful as the seeds that I save. And my question to you is, can I have a hug?
I didn't get the last bit.
May I have a hug?
Of course, if they let you come up on the stage.
But we have a one hug rule tonight.
Inspiration to me personally. I am a local certified organic farmer, and many of my farmer friends and supporters are in this audience tonight. And I think we on Vancouver Island, farmers, are the answer to many of what you're talking about. Yeah. If every time you went to buy something, you went to one of the local farmers markets, you went to one of the farm stands, you went and found your local farmers, you would be going a long way to solve certainly the problems on Vancouver Island and effectively down the road, down the river, around the world. I also think at this time, there is a huge opportunity for the university, and the question that was just asked, can UVic be a leader? Many of you would have read the unfortunate circumstances that are happening to the Van Trite Farm. That could be a huge opportunity for the university. I think $1.6 million is a small price to pay for 40 acres of prime farmland. And I think that an undertaking could happen. UVic could become a leader in so many ways, and I think you encourage us to do that. Thank you.
So just as the ground rules are only one hug, also a question should be short, succinct, and finished with a question mark. Gentleman on top right there.
Thank you very much for the wonderful speech, Dr. Shiva. I'd just like to know what's your opinion on how to address our overall consumption level, which is rising significantly within the next few years. I think the world population should be 10 billion, and a significant portion of that is from rising economies which demand these goods that's made from genetically modified organisms. So how do you propose that we address those needs as well?
I have not seen a single community culture country saying, give me GM food. No one. Yes, those changes in economy, for example, China, with its increase in meat eating and all the export of GM soya, that is taking place. The nice thing with food is, you know, there's a limit to how much you can eat. So no matter how much wealthier you become, if you eat two chapatis, you will eat two chapatis. You might buy more and more expensive t-shirts. And that's why for me food is the ultimate equalizer. Because it's set by ecological and biological limits. In terms of the consumer culture, I've done lots of critiques of it because I think we are much more than what we consume and buy. We are what we create. That's why gardens, gardening, farming are so important, because it's one place where we co-create with the earth and actually relieve the burden of the earth. And for that, I feel so happy to see young people everywhere wanting to garden, wanting to farm. This is a major cultural shift. And just like Gandhi pulled out the Swiss spinning wheel and said, this is not primitive, it is totally relevant to creating freedom, and he brought the spinning wheel back. Young people turning to use their hands are saying no to the definitions of obsolescence and primitiveness that an industry that lives on obsolescence and primitiveness would like to impose on us.
Vandana, thank you so much. I feel you have just blessed. I live on one of the islands just north of here called Gabriola. There's a few of us here. I feel you have just blessed this whole part of the world with this message that is so important. I write about food. I rant about it at times. I admire your ability to stand up to bullies. And I just want to know if there's a special blessing that Indian people or that you say when you give thanks for your food.
When we give thanks to food, first we apologize to the earth. We celebrate the seed. We remind ourselves the seed is not our property, but is a commons. And when you eat, you recognize the food is creation itself.
With regard to the companies like that produce Roundup, Monsanto, is it possible to have this their poisons and pesticides banned from countries like and just in an outright manner?
You know, when I read out that new law, it's about immunity. It's about not having any law govern you, which is why when situations like this happen, it's from the community level we have to create another civic law. I'm writing with some of the top breeders of the world and some of the best lawyers of the world who have fought against patenting and biopiracy. We're writing a law of the seed. And we know it'll have to grow from the ground up. And there might be a few governments here and there that'll pick it up. I'm also thinking, I get messages and information from Argentina where the whole nation has been destroyed by Roundup Ready soya, where they spray Roundup from the air. Or Hawaii, which has become a major seed production center, and they spray the pesticides and herbicides from the air. That is warfare. And I do think we need, if the companies are getting immunity through government, we as people need to hold them to account.
Thank you very, very much.
for your great work around the world. It has been very inspiring to me, and I thank you as an organic farmer. It's been really important. And my question is do you think, Vandana Shiva, that the people here would be willing to sign this petition for a GE-free Vancouver Island? Yes?
I think we won't make you answer that question.
Well, I think you live in paradise. And wouldn't it be sad if you allowed this paradise to be destroyed? Because everywhere where GMOs go, biodiversity goes. Farmers go. The earth's beauty and abundance goes. So protect this beautiful land. You've received it from such amazing communities. Make it GE-free.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm just wondering what you think about poetry's effect on the environmental movement and its potential to change social consciousness.
Can you actually repeat the question?
Oh, okay.
And into the mic.
You cited two poems in your conclusion, and I'm just wondering what you think about poetry's effect on the environmental movement and its potential to change social consciousness.
Poetry.
I was hearing poultry, and I was and I was thinking you were talking about factory chicken or the genetically engineered chicken in Israel, which has no feathers, so you wouldn't have to spend money on plucking the feathers. Poetry. This movement will spread through gardens and organic farms. And for all of you organic farmers, thank you for cultivating another future. But the other place where it will grow is through the arts, through music, through painting, through film, through poetry. So write lots of poetry on food.
We have maybe time for three more questions. And the lady on top there.
Donna, thanks for everything you do. I bring you greetings from the BC Food Systems Network, Brewster, Kathleen, and Food Secure Canada. We're having a little challenge right now at Food Secure Canada with the Conference Board of Canada and the usual suspects, large corporations who are writing a national food strategy. Have you got any stories or great ideas about how to speak directly to government?
I think when governments are hijacked by corporations, then you speak indirectly to them by speaking directly to each other.
I'm not going to ask you to sign my petition for GE-free Gabriola Island. There are 13 areas in British Columbia that have declared themselves GE-free. Vancouver Island is moving in the right direction. Gabriola Island is moving in the right direction. And all I want is a yes from you.
Jiva, hello. Thank you very much for speaking. I'm one of six people here from the Kwantlen Sustainable Greenhouse Club. It's part of Kwantlen Polytechnic University in Langley. We recently launched a seed library open to the Fraser Valley community, encouraging the public to grow open-pollinated varieties and cultivate diversity and adaptation to the Fraser Valley area. We have over 400 donations, and the public is really taking this into stride. It's been due to people who are inspirational like you that have helped us actually take action in our community and develop something that will hopefully live on in legacy and grow. My question is, when genetic engineering was introduced about 20 years ago, there was a promise that it would not pollute, and there was a promise that the pollen could be controlled, which we all know to be nonsense. How do we take action against such a violent violation of our rights have this imposed on us? How do we take the first step in that?
Well, first, by declaring your regions GMO-free, so you reduce the risk of that pollution. But secondly, you know, there is an international law called the Biosafety Protocol. And it's just that the US has not signed up to it, but I think Canadians, Canada is a signatory. So use those international instruments, and eventually we will have to have liability, whether it is for toxic contamination, destruction of our food, as well as for genetic contamination. There's a very important case in the US where 80 groups joined, and they asked Navdanian to join, of organic seed growers and organic farmers wanting a preventive step for not being sued after contamination using patents and intellectual property rights, because normally in any kind of pollution, the polluter must pay. That's the international law. With patents and genetic engineering, the polluter gets paid. And that's the Percy case. So it's all standing on its head. And I think we need, I mean, the question on poetry, I think one is we need our words back. We need our imagination back. We need our poetry back. Because the double, if I read out to you the language that is used, GMOs are not called GMOs anymore. They're called events. Event MON 810. Event MON 3560. It's like this evening's event, which I think should now come to a close.
Can we have one more question? There's a very young lady over there, and I think we should give her the last question.
Why don't everyone plant a seed this weekend? A healthy one.
I don't think that was a question.
No, I didn't.
I think that was a comment.
Whatever you said, it was wonderful.
So,
oh, wonderful. See, I said it was wonderful.
Dr. Schieber, thank you for such a wonderful presentation and for staying to answer these questions. It's really appreciated. And that concludes the formal part of this evening. We hope that you'll visit the 50th anniversary celebration booth and bookstore booth in the lobby on your way out. I want to thank not all of you in the audience here, but also those who are listening by or are watching by my webcast from the David Strong Building for coming tonight. Safe journey home. Good evening. And Dr. Schieber, once more, thank you so much.